These days, just about every graph in China looks something like this. GDP growth is down. Foreign investment is down. Tourism is down. You name it. Retail sales, consumer confidence, the housing market, even population growth. All down. In other words, all lights are flashing red for Xi Jinping. But the one that should worry him the most, the one that would keep any leader up at night, is this one, youth unemployment. Before it began manipulating the data late last year, the government reported that 21% of the population aged 16 to 24 was unemployed. And that, mind you, includes only those actively looking for work. When you add those who've given up, the actual number could be as high as 46%, according to a professor of economics at one of China's top universities. Conservatively, that's about 31 million angry, disillusioned young men and women with nothing to do. And historically, there's been no bigger threat to Chinese leaders. The last time Beijing was bursting with so many restless students, the year was 1989. Needless to say, not one it's keen to repeat. The protests at Tiananmen Square taught the party that the biggest threats to its survival come from within. Today, despite having a $180 billion budget for national defense, Beijing spends even more on internal security. Another enduring lesson is that the flames of broader political upheaval are often ignited by the sparks of relatively mundane economic upheaval. Over the past 30 years, our memory of Tiananmen has been slowly reduced to a single word, democracy. And not without reason. Some of its most powerful symbols explicitly call for political change. But like most popular movements, these high-minded ideals were catalyzed by frustrations over much more trivial issues like inflation, corruption, and yes, unemployment. So you can imagine how terrified the party was 8 years later, during the Asian financial crisis, when unemployment reached its highest level on record. In 1997, 6 million workers were laid off by its state-owned enterprises. The next year, 7 million. And the one after that, another 8. In total, that's more than 3 times as many manufacturing jobs as the United States has lost over the past 40 years. But even more dangerous were all the 16, 17, and 18-year-olds that would soon enter the labor force, where they would immediately hit a brick wall, unable to compete with those 21 million older, more experienced candidates. Unemployment, of course, is always a political liability, but particularly during the critical transition between school and career. After a lifetime of diligence and anticipation, you're either embraced by and absorbed into the establishment or bitterly estranged from it. One path leads you to identify with and invest in the status quo, the other to reject it. Well, the party watched nervously as the youth of Indonesia rejected it, deposing their president after 32 years in power. Meanwhile, Tiananmen was still fresh in its memory. So too was the collapse of the Soviet Union, the country on which it was modeled. Could China be next? So, rather than unleash these millions of soon-to-be angry 18-year-olds into the labor force, it decided, at the last minute, to bribe them. And in China's education-obsessed society, there's no sweeter bribe than admission to an elite university. Before 1998, even attending high school in China was a rare privilege. Only a tiny sliver of a tiny minority, just one out of every 12 kids, made it to college. And if it had continued on that path as it planned to, enrollment may have looked something like this, doubling from 3.5 to 7 million or so students by 2013. After all, China's per capita GDP at the time was less than $900, equivalent to Mali or Rwanda today. An economy of this size simply didn't need that many lawyers or architects. Instead, Beijing overruled its own bureaucracy and issued an emergency directive: get as many bodies in classrooms as physically possible. Over the next 12 months alone, new enrollment increased by almost 60%, with zero preparation. Students stood at the back of classrooms, teachers worked overtime, and schools rushed to take out loans. By 2013, total enrollment had doubled, and doubled, and doubled, and doubled again, all the way to 35 million. Quickly, as you can see, doesn't do this justice. But chaotic as it was, the plan worked. In the short term, the party got millions of feet off the streets, where their minds might start to wander, and into classrooms, under its watchful gaze. What better way to reduce unemployment than drawing millions of applicants out of the labor force entirely? But, far more importantly, it gave anxious middle-class families a seat at the table, recruiting would-be dissidents as defenders of the establishment. Now, had it stopped there, this could have ended disastrously for the party. In 1989, thousands of college students assembled at Tiananmen Square, demanding political change. Now, less than 10 years later, here it was increasing the number of students by 1,600%. Gather millions of diverse, idealistic 18-year-olds in a walkable communal environment, free them from labor, and tell them to think critically. What could possibly go wrong? Perhaps in some alternate universe, this may have been the first domino to fall, putting China on the path to democratic reform, like Taiwan. These comfortable, newly minted elites may have demanded that their voices be heard. Typically, the more you give, the more people come to expect. But here's the trick. Beijing never actually gave anything, except opportunity. The bribe was conditional. The party would open the gates of university to all, but you had to fight your way through them, and it wouldn't be easy. Schools began charging tuition for the first time, and the government stopped assigning jobs to graduates. From then on, success was your individual responsibility. After 1998, even the silver-spooned elite now had to compete with millions of new, hungry-like-their-life-depended-on-it middle- and working-class rural achievers. No one could get complacent. Sure, there are the obvious reasons that Chinese college campuses haven't since 89 been the hotbeds of activism they have elsewhere. Censorship, punishment, surveillance, and a universal, if slightly clumsy, curriculum of patriotic education. But not to be overlooked is the simple fact that no one has time. Preoccupied with an endless stream of exams, tutoring, and homework, you'll be lucky to eat breakfast, never mind read Tocqueville. The secret ingredient is scarcity. Scarcity creates a zero-sum competition. Competition leads to middle-class anxiety, and this anxiety leads to a low-trust culture that prevents any sense of solidarity. Partly, this is just necessity. China still doesn't have the per capita wealth of other authoritarian states like the UAE or Qatar, which can generously distribute their oil riches among tiny populations. It's never had enough teachers, classrooms, or schools for everyone. In fact, even as college enrollment more than doubled in the 1990s, the number of universities actually decreased by 3%. Its sheer size alone meant that not just many, but most would be left behind. As recently as 2015, only 12% of its workforce had ever been to college, less than half the OECD average, and less than 30% had even a high school education. But China turned this weakness, scarcity, into an advantage, providing just enough opportunity to fuel the time-intensive rat race, but never enough to make anyone too comfortable. Now, the only reason any of this worked, the only reason suddenly increasing enrollment by 1,000% didn't just delay mass unemployment by 4 years when those students graduated, was China's equally fast economic growth. 4 years was practically a lifetime in 1990s China. By the time that first expanded class graduated in 2002, the country's economy had grown by an astounding 42%, creating enough new jobs to absorb them all. And the party rode this wave as long as it could. But things started to change in the mid-2010s. Since then, economic growth has slowed. Yet, college enrollment, remember, is driven by political, not economic, need. Thus, as a larger and larger middle class has been bribed with admission, the gap between the number of graduates and the number of white-collar positions has grown. At first, this worked to the party's advantage. As the supply of elite positions fell relative to demand, the competition to get them intensified. And this shift in power from employee to employer made the former even more compliant, allowing China to squeeze every last drop of productivity out of its workers as their numbers dwindled and the country's economic model transitioned away from manufacturing. Thus, for instance, the rise of exploitative 996 work arrangements, 9 a.m. to 9 p.m. shifts, 6 days a week. The average Chinese worker clocks in nearly 2,200 hours a year, about 60% more than their counterparts in Germany, and 20% more than notoriously work-obsessed Americans. The problem with increasing scarcity, though, is that it's a bit like stretching a rubber band. You can squeeze more and more out of the same resource right up until the band snaps, often without warning. When getting ahead gets harder, students study more diligently and workers stay in the office later. But when it begins to feel impossible, they become disillusioned, disengaged, and disaffected. Admittedly, this is difficult to quantify, but there are signs China may be nearing that tipping point. You can see it in the sudden and alarming rise in lottery ticket sales, a cheap source of hope when none can be found elsewhere. You can see it in the 16 million so-called professional children, adults who've simply given up on finding a job. You can see it in the coinage of new Chinese terms related to frustration, alienation, and hopelessness. And you can see it in the familiar romanticizing of alternative lifestyles. There are now hippies, goths, punks, hipsters, and Silicon Valley-style yogis with Chinese characteristics. Now, we know from the past 30 years that inequality alone is no threat to the party's legitimacy. Recall that the vast majority of the population still doesn't hold a college degree. Most people attribute this to their own failures, on the objective high school and college entrance exams, for example. What is dangerous is when this failure coalesces along visible and arbitrary social lines, suggesting that the haves and the have-nots are beneficiaries and victims of forces beyond their control. And today, that fault line is generational. China's overall unemployment rate is no higher than it normally is, but its youth unemployment rate has been rapidly growing since 2018. And there's evidence that young Chinese are becoming aware of these disparities. Between 2004 and 2014, the Golden Age, researchers asked thousands of Chinese citizens to rank 10 reasons why some people in China are poor. The top three answers were lack of ability, lack of effort, and low education. In other words, individual failures. A decade later, in 2023, researchers went back and asked the same question again. This time, two of the top three answers were unequal opportunity and unfair economic system. In other words, systemic failures. Meanwhile, the number one reason they said people are rich went from ability and talent to connections. Of course, China is not alone. You'd be hard-pressed to find a trend here that doesn't apply to the United States, for example. But a few things make China's challenges even more politically dangerous. First, there are fewer outlets for discontent. Not only can you not make your voice heard in any meaningful way, but the range of socially approved careers and lifestyles is much narrower, which is guaranteed to make some feel claustrophobic. Short of outright resistance, there aren't many ways for those angry, unemployed 21-year-olds to express themselves. And while the carrots, the rewards for compliance, are nowhere near what they used to be, the sticks are as sharp as ever. And secondly, there's a difference of speed and scale. Whereas American baby boomers and Gen Z are separated by two whole generations, producing a more subtle, if still noticeable, gradient, in China, the haves and the have-nots are directly adjacent, parent and child, making for a more stark contrast. A 21-year-old who graduates college this spring and struggles to find work will have had their career and life expectations shaped by their parents, who were likely born in the mid-1970s. Those parents would have grown up during China's fastest ever pace of development, from this to this in a single childhood. And they would have graduated in the late 90s, right at the peak of the boom years, when the economy was growing almost twice as fast. It's hard not to conclude that the train has left the station, and that young Chinese have simply missed it. In absolute terms, China really is more prosperous than it was, say, in the 90s. The problem, of course, is that most people define success in relative terms. Am I better off than my parents? Meanwhile, simply by attending college, these students are already among the luckiest in China. The truly poor don't even have the luxury of opting out of the rat race and living off the grid. And yet, it's precisely this combination of relative privilege and relative deprivation that makes the middle class so politically combustible. They live in cities where they're visible, they have high expectations for life, and they're experienced at navigating the system. For the past 50 years, the quote, free world has been waiting for the Chinese people to spontaneously rise up and demand democracy, as if confirming that our system is the inevitable final form that all countries evolve toward. We see what we want to see, and we can't help but assume everyone thinks like we do. Which is why we've collectively rewritten Tiananmen as a democracy movement, pure and simple, when the man who wrote the definitive book on it has said, quote, "While a few activists did take democracy as a primary goal, most participated in reaction to China's rising market economy." In other words, middle-class concerns like inflation and unemployment triggered widespread frustration. Frustration which a few skillfully leveraged to demand sweeping political change. This is no indictment of the protests, not at all. Nearly every noble movement has begun with what in hindsight seem like trivial complaints. And if China ever sees another, it'll likely follow the exact same pattern. Now, this bias towards seeing what we want to see is understandable. Clearly, bias is inescapable, even with the best intentions. Which is why I use and recommend today's sponsor, Ground News. Ground News is a website and app that gives you a more transparent way to read the news. Each day, they collect thousands of articles across the world and compile them into easy-to-read stories, each with a breakdown of bias, factuality, and ownership. Distinguishing the good sources from the bad is a good first step, but the most informed readers, in my opinion, go one step further. They don't just avoid bad sources, they see how bias affects all sources, allowing them to come to their own, more nuanced conclusions. Ground News gives you the tools to do that. Take a headline like this one. U.S. calls on a silent China to use its sway over Russia and North Korea. Seemingly, this is straightforward and objective. Most of the headlines seem pretty similar. And yet, we can see that only the left has covered it extensively, by a ratio of 6-1, which gives us a clue that this might be less straightforward than we first imagined. Fortunately, we can now use the Ground News summary feature to uncover what that bias might be. we can see that only the coverage on the left emphasizes China's diverging interests from North Korea. The latter wants to build up its defenses, whereas China prefers not to provoke the US and its allies. And just like that, in a few seconds, we've uncovered a massive, ongoing debate in the China-watching community. Some argue that China, North Korea, and Russia are close, inseparable allies, suggesting a new Cold War alliance. Others say they're less unified than they may appear, and that we may be able to pry them apart. These are subtle, easy-to-miss distinctions, even for the seasoned reader. Without ground news, we likely would have missed them entirely. And if you're a numbers person, you can even track your news consumption stats, which sources you read the most, where they lean politically, and who owns them. Best of all, Ground News is currently offering 50% off their Vantage plan, which gives you unlimited access to all their features. This is their biggest discount yet. When you're ready to try Ground News, go to ground.news/polymatter, tap the QR code on screen now, or use the link in the description. You'll become a more informed reader and help support an independent news platform working to make the news media more transparent.